You're listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Music in a rational universe.
Hi.
Welcome to Scopes Monkey Choir.
Welcome to Scopes Monkey Choir, episode 61. And we're going to be really brief here because we have an interview. This is going to be a part of the continuing series of what Haiting does with her free time when she's on a world tour.
It's very exciting. I call up scientists and ask to talk to them.
Yeah.
Now, I got this idea, as I may have said last week, because I'm in the cast of Einstein on the Beach. And so we were in Ann Arbor. And I saw that they had arranged this whole series of lectures on physics by various physicists and historians of science and people who know a lot about Einstein. And among them was Peter Galison, physicist and science historian and professor at Harvard and
an
all
author.
Around. Yes, author most recently of Einstein's Clocks, Poincaré's Maps.
Right.
So go buy Peter Galison's book. He was very kind to speak to me early in the morning, and this is what he said.
Good morning. I'm sitting here with Peter Galison, who is a physicist and historian of science, I believe.
And that's right.
You're here to give a talk in conjunction with the performances of Einstein on the Beach. So why don't you tell me a little bit about your expertise and why you were chosen to do such a thing?
Well, so I teach, as you say, history of science, philosophy of science, and physics at Harvard. My deepest interest is in the way that abstract ideas in science are connected to very material realities. And a lot of the work that I've done orbits around that question. In the case of Einstein, my work has been about Einstein's original work in the patent office and with machines. People think of Einstein as somebody who lived entirely in the cloud cuckoo land and is unable to cope with the reality of the physical world. But in fact, Einstein was, as a young man, deeply involved with instruments and technologies. He holds patents on... He has a patent on a navigation device using gyroscopic navigation. He has a patent on refrigerators. He has very original and interesting ideas about the technical world. And he served for many years. The job that he had was not in academia at all. He was in a patent office. And he wrote his great paper on special relativity, the idea that space and time were relative to the observer, while he was a patent officer. So he was sitting there with a kind of ringside seat to the parade of modernity that was going by in Central Europe. And he was particularly interested in everything that had to do with radio waves and the new theories of electricity and magnetism. So he was really somebody who was trying to use his scientific expertise and his sort of clarity of distinguishing where principles were applied and what was possible and what wasn't and what was necessary in a device and what wasn't and what was repeated from one device to another and what was truly original, to try to assess the patents that came across his desk, the patent proposals that came across his desk every day. So I wrote a book called Einstein's Clocks, Poincaré's Maps.
Yes.
About locating Einstein and his older contemporary, Henri Poincaré, the great French mathematician, philosopher, and physicist, as they grappled with this very, what we think of as the most abstract of questions, namely, what is the nature of space, what is the nature of time, and how is the new physics that was opening up in the late 19th and early 20th century going to change those? So I was invited here by the Humanities Center to talk about the relationship of Einstein to his world, and it seemed like a good occasion to do it in conjunction with the renewed performance of Einstein on the Beach.
Have you been asked to relate the talk at all to the work by Philip Glass and Robert Wilson, or are you just giving your own talk and letting their work stand on its own?
I will say a few things about it. I haven't seen the current performance in... I don't know much about how it's being restaged.
Did you see it in...
So I have seen...
1992?
I've seen film from it, and I know the opera. But Einstein's work has interacted with the arts over a very long time, and it really begins in earnest in November of 1919, when later Sir Arthur Eddington, mounted an expedition to try to check one of the predictions that Einstein had made from his general theory of relativity that was published during World War I in 1915.
Which prediction did he...
So this prediction was that space and time would be bent in such a way that light that traveled near an object would be bent, and so it would be bent a lot if it went by the starlight, for instance, went by the sun. So during a total eclipse, when you can see the area of the sky near the sun, otherwise you can't because the sun's very bright. We have a great feature of our world, of our universe, is that the moon looks the same size as the sun. So when the moon passes in front of the sun, it's just a total accident. Didn't have to be that way, but it is.
Although creationists sometimes make great hay of this, but...
I'll pass on the creationist question for this conversation.
Please do.
But the moon, when it's in front of the sun, exactly blocks out the sun. So you can see stars that are very nearby. And as the light... a star that was, say, that would normally appear to be, if light was not bent by the sun, would when it goes by the sun, is bent like if you threw one magnet nearby another magnet, would be bent slightly as it went around.
This is gravitational lensing.
It is related to gravitational lensing, in fact, and you're right that because of this effect, you can have gravitational lensing. You could have an object. Let's hold off on that.
This is the physical effect that causes gravitational lensing.
Anyway, Eddington mounted this expedition to check Einstein's theory and found that, in fact, the stars look like they've changed position because their light's been bent. So that's very interesting, and that caused, in November of 1919, a huge explosion of interest in Einstein. It was front page news on many newspapers all around the world. And artists, architects, musicians, poets reacted hugely. Every contemporary poet at the time, William Carlos Williams, E.E. Cummings, T.S. Eliot, everybody wrote in one way or another about Einstein. And Buckminster Fuller and many architects began to think about it about the theory of relativity in that period. I mean, it was often a loose association. I mean, William Carlos Williams used it as a way of backing his ideas that he was beginning to develop about the possibility of a different foot in the poetic sense being possible than the way conventional poetry had been structured. E. Cummings used it for other purposes. Buckminster Fuller used it in his Dymaxion designs. I mean, his new ideas about configuring space. I mean, it was not a detailed use of differential geometry or Einstein's theory in its details, but it was a sense that Einstein, by taking what people had thought to be the eternal verities of the universe, the sort of the fixed points of space and time, especially as something as, I mean, I don't know if I should say this, but as poetic as the bending of starlight, it seemed suddenly that he had addressed the modern condition in some way, and it came just a short period of time after the end of this unbelievably bloody conflict of World War I, and you had a British scientist, Eddington, checking the Germans' theory. They were both pacifists. Eddington was a very committed Quaker, and Einstein was a pacifist during World War I, much to the annoyance of his German colleagues. So it seemed to signify very broadly. And since that time, since 1919, over the years, in artistic works, painting, and in poetry, and in many other areas, Einstein became a kind of icon of the possibility of challenging conventions, of standing outside of the fixed rules and conventions that had been established from the past. Even the face of Einstein appears in some Dadaist paintings as an icon of modernity. Mm-hmm. So I think that in the Wilson and Glass opera, in a way, they're part of a long artistic tradition when they are looking to Einstein, not so much for the details of the theory of relativity or his ideas about the quantum, but really as a way of using some of his ideas, like the idea of E equals MC squared, that plays a important, if limited, role within the building of the atomic bomb, and which figures in the as a theme that wanders its way through the anxious moments of the early 1970s when the opera was first performed, of ideas of space and time, of repetition, of rhythm. So I think that's quite evocative. And in historical terms, there are ways that you could describe Einstein as somewhat classical as well as breaking with the past. But whether you describe, you know, a curve in the road as the end of the road and going in one direction or the beginning of the road going in another is a somewhat arbitrary thing. But Einstein stood as a kind of curve in the road. Mm-hmm. And I think that for the 20th century, for the long 20th century, and even now, Einstein remains a kind of touchstone of our culture.
One of the images that I spent a lot of time looking at yesterday while I was doing nothing on stage is the train.
Yes.
And can you talk about the close association of trains with Einstein and the is that the general relativity with the clocks and the different measurement of time?
So early in the, I mean, the train is a fantastic technology because it really was transformative in the 19th century in many ways. But one of the things that it did was it gave people a vertiginous sense of speed and the connectivity of places. It's hard for us to remember how difficult it was to move before trains. Mm-hmm. I mean, going across the United States or going across much of Russia or other places was, you know, where you had a big spatial extent. But even in the European countries, it was really hard getting around, basically using horses. Or if you were in a coastal, you know, had a coastal trajectory, you could take boats. But it was harder to get from Boston in the 18th century to the western suburbs of Boston, what are now the western suburbs of Boston, than it was to get from England to Boston. If you wanted to move goods, it was often more costly to move them from Boston to Worcester than, you know, which is not that far from Boston, than it was from London or Birmingham or one of the cities in England to Boston. And going from the East Coast to the West Coast of the United States was expensive, it was dangerous, and it was long. Mm. And you had a lot of bad alternatives. Before the Panama Canal, you had to go around the continent all the way. And that was a very dangerous trip. If you wanted to go overland, it was difficult. So the train helped give people a sense of connection. It was formative of our sense of, not just in the United States, but elsewhere, of connected nationhood, of linked cultures. But the speed also meant that things that hadn't been an issue before suddenly were. Like, if you look, we know very well that we have time zones. But that wasn't always so. Those weren't needed until you had trains. If you were walking or taking a horse or boats from some place to some other place, you moved slowly enough that when you got there, you reset, you got used to the new time. And each little town in the United States, for instance, had its own time. The jeweler in the town would set a clock to the noonday sun, the highest point of the sun, and that would be noon for that town. And then everybody would set their clocks by the jeweler, and nothing really mattered that much from, 5 minutes or 7 minutes or 10 minutes late. But with trains, that became different because they had to run on schedules. And the first time zones were these, hundreds of mile long tracks and 3 miles, three feet wide. So if you had a train that ran from New York to central Pennsylvania, the track would have the time of New York on it. Or if it started in Chicago or it started in Philadelphia, wherever it started, that was the time of the track. Okay, that worked pretty well. But that meant that when the track went through small town X, that the town had two times, the town time and the train time. And people could deal with that. There were two times. But now what happens if you have two trains that cross? So suppose you have a track that comes from Chicago and a track that comes from New York. Now you have three times when they cross. You have the town time of the crossing point. You have the Chicago time track and the New York time track. Now you want to change trains. Which do you use? And you can imagine as things got more complicated and many tracks began to cross, it became hopeless. How could you even draw a schedule? So people, the train companies essentially got together and carved up the world into 24 sections, each of which would have its own like slices of an orange that would each have its own time. But that meant having the technical ability to distribute time and to send out over telegraph wires synchronization signals to synchronize clocks. And so suddenly this idea of synchronized time became very important for the world. A world speeded up and connected began to think about time as it became a problem in a way it hadn't been before. But there's another reason too, and Poincaré, Einstein's sometimes rival and sometimes model, was an important figure in this, and that is that if you want to know where you are in the world, you navigate, like are you about to get stuck on a sandbar off of Cape Cod or crash into the shoals off of Ireland, and you really need to know where you are. And so as soon as they could lay cables across the ocean, they began sending signals to say, you know, hey, it's 12 o'clock, you're in London, and then you get it, and the person in New York would say, wonderful, it's you know, 5:53 here, so I know I'm somewhere between 5 and 6 hours, I'm between 75 and 90 degrees over, and so on. So that became a big issue, and the problem of coordinating clocks for map making was crucial, and it was parasitic on the laying of cables all over the world. And in fact, you could, you know, the international cable system that was set up at the end of the 19th century was the, you know, a kind of internet avant la lettre. I mean, that was the first globalized communication network. And it was the world's biggest machine. I mean, it was millions of pounds of cable laid all over the world, up into the mountains and across the undersea cables, along the oceans, along coasts. The French began to lay cables along the coast of Africa. The British had cables running to Vietnam. And I mean, it was a world-covering network. It was a military necessity. It allowed you to say, you know, turn around the ships. There's a revolt in the empire over here. We need more cannons over there. And the British basically controlled the world telegraphic network for a while, and the French suspected that they were listening in on all the French communications, and the French were correct about that. They were. And the British had a bunch of ships that went around cutting other people's cables when it was convenient to them. So they really ran it. The French never had a very extensive network, but they did run cables to Senegal and other places. And Poincaré was one of the people in charge of the Paris Bureau of Longitude, which was doing these measurements to try to determine exactly where things were. Say, in Senegal, you wanted to build a railroad, you wanted to fight an anti-insurrectionary war, whatever you wanted to do, you needed to know what the longitude was as well as the latitude. So these questions of, and then people began to say, okay, well, now let's get really accurate. Actually, if we send a signal from Paris to Recife in Brazil, it's not instantaneous. So when they get the signal that says it's 12 o'clock in London, it's not 12 o'clock in London. It's 12 o'clock plus a little bit of time. Mm-hmm. Well, you say, how long could that be? Well, if it's 6,000 miles to Recife, that's a 30th of a second for light to get that far. And in a cable, it's a little slower. A 30th of a second is completely measurable by the end of the 19th century. Mm. Absolutely, unequivocally clear. And so in the reports, what they would do is they'd send a signal, bounce it back, say it would take a 15th of a second, and then they'd say, oh, okay, so one way it's a 30th of a second. And so when I send you a signal at 12 o'clock, set your clocks to 12, your London clock to 12 o'clock plus a 15th of a second. So that became a routine for Poincaré and all the people in Washington and Paris and London who were running these networks. And what Einstein and Poincaré did was to say, you know what, this isn't just a useful technology. This is actually what we mean by simultaneity. What we mean by simultaneity are a set of equivalently functioning clocks that are coordinated by exchanging a signal between them, an electrical signal between them, and then using that to set up, to set the clocks to be simultaneous. That's what we mean by simultaneous. So if I say two events occur, you're in Detroit and I'm in Los Angeles, and they two events occur at the same time, I mean that we both have the same reading on our clocks after those clocks have been coordinated by the exchange of a signal. Now, this may seem like no big deal, but it is. It really begins to change the idea that simultaneity is something absolute, which is what Newton and everybody had believed until the late 19th century, early 20th century. And once you rigorously enforce this idea, then it turns out that different observers who are traveling along disagree about what's simultaneous. So if our friends Jill and Jane are going by on a long train, and they travel by us at some very high speed, two events that we consider to be simultaneous, they won't. And two events that they consider to be simultaneous, we won't. That simultaneity turns out to be relative to the frame, once you define simultaneity to be coordinated clocks that are set up by the exchange of signals.
And is this because of the time that it takes the signal to travel between clocks, or is it because of some more vital nature of...
It's not exactly that, but it depends on the fact that we've coordinated clocks in a certain way. But I mean, for instance, if we set a flashing lamp between us and exactly halfway, and it sends a signal to you and a signal to me, we'll get them at that could coordinate our clocks, because mm-hmm. it's just light traveling in different directions but the same distance. But if someone were to go travel by us, and they were traveling quickly, and they got to the middle point between us, and say you flashed a light towards the center and I flashed a light towards the center, and they were moving towards you, they would intercept. They would say, "Oh well, I'm gonna arrive at your light signal earlier than the one from me, because mine got to catch up with me as I'm moving," and so they'll disagree. They will not say that those two flashes that we consider to have been emitted simultaneously arrived at them simultaneously. Since they think they were halfway between us, they would conclude that one of them was sent before the other. The point is, the real point here, is that the very practical necessities of the 19th century that made simultaneity and time and signaling a crucial part of the 19th century world was formative and gave the possibility of challenging old ideas about what simultaneity and space were.
Now, forgive the pun, but is this the train of thought that led to the idea that light has a fixed speed?
It's sort of the other way around, that for Einstein, and also Poincaré, that they knew that we never measured light traveling at any speed other than 186,000 miles per second. And that was one of the things that was necessary for concluding that simultaneity is relative to the observer.
How did they originally measure that speed?
Well, that goes back before Einstein and Poincaré, but they were very clever experiments. For instance, if you take a spinning disk that has little slices in it, like little pie-shaped slices, and you spin it quickly and you shine a light from in back of it, a distant mirror to a distant mirror, then it takes time for that flash of light to hit the mirror and come back. And by changing the speed of the spinning disk, you can judge very clearly whether the light, how long it takes for the light to go round trip. Mm-hmm. And this meant that you could get a very precise measure of how long the round trip took, and therefore what the speed of light is. Mm-hmm. But there were other ways, too. For instance, you know the distance to Jupiter, and you know, say, one of its moons. Galileo discovered the moons of Jupiter in the early 1600s. But the distance changes between the Earth and Jupiter at different times.
Depending on the orbits.
Depending on the orbits. And Jupiter can be a long way from the Earth, or it can be...
Slightly less long.
but it can be a big difference. If Jupiter and the Earth are on the same side of the Sun or on the opposite sides of the Sun, it can be a huge difference in their distance to the Earth. So you know when, say, one of its moons should become visible, because you can just calculate it. It's going around every so
many days.
One of
them has a very steady... They knew that one of them took exactly 42 hours to go around.
So you could then look at the difference between when you expected, when if you say you knew it, that it was going to come around at one time, and when it was on the same side of Jupiter was on the same side of the Sun as the Earth, and what happened when it was on the other side, and there was a delay compared to what you expected its emergence from behind Jupiter to be.
But it's not that the period of the orbit changed.
No.
But rather,
it just takes time for the light to get to us.
So, but the say 42 hours that it takes for the Moon to go around Jupiter, that wouldn't change because of the of the relative.
That doesn't change. It's just that say the emergence of the Moon from behind Jupiter would occur at we would know
a
when we would expect
Earth time.
it to come than it did. And that delay is because it's farther away. It's got nothing to do with, in fact, we assume that the Moon is going around Jupiter at the same rate, whether it's on our side of the Sun or not. There's no reason why it should change. So that was a very early way of estimating the speed of light.
I see. Did they know how far away Jupiter
was
at that point?
Yeah, they did. I think the broad question that you asked is really, the really central question is, how do we think about artistic works in relationship to Einstein and relativity? And I think that what's so remarkable is that for coming on 100 years, Einstein's theories have served as a jumping-off point, not as a literal model, but as a jumping-off point for artistic projects of all kinds in every different medium. And I think that the remarkable feature of Einstein on the Beach is the way that it plays with these themes of time and repetition and number, but also it was also a piece written in the fears and anxieties of the Cold War, and the atomic bomb looms very much over the piece. There's something threatening, exhilarating and threatening about the figure of Einstein, which becomes the figure of science or the figure of rationality in some way. And this very simply stated equation, which is no doubt the most famous equation in the history of all science, E equals MC squared, was both a symbol of this revolutionary philosophical physical theory, but also of this threat. You have an equation which seemed in compact form to express both hopes for a new world and the fears of a Cold War, mm-hmm. which by the early 70s was extremely threatening, and both sides had tens of thousands of nuclear weapons, and I think that that's different about, I mean, that's something that's not present, obviously, in the period of 1919 to 1945. I mean, whatever Einstein symbolizes, it isn't that.
Yeah.
But you have this confluence on the one side of Einstein as a symbol of modernity, of a revolutionary break with traditional and constraining thought, which appealed to artists, which already had a long history of appealing to artists. And then after World War II, you had Einstein and the E equals MC squared, which came out of relativity theory, as also a state-changing military fact about mm-hmm. the world of the greatest and most transformative sort. So, you know, by the early 1950s, you had thermonuclear weapons, hydrogen bombs. By the 60s, you had arsenals of intercontinental ballistic missiles mm-hmm. with atomic bombs on them. By the 70s, these were stationed all over the world, and the world was in a kind of hair-trigger alert. So I think that that's something that, in the cultural background of what Einstein symbolized in that period, what the icon represented. And you can see, for instance, if you look at the cover of Time magazine, Einstein was on it many times. And first he goes from this sort of thinker, dreamer, you know, revolutionary figure of thought, and eventually, you know, there's Einstein and the mushroom cloud and E equals MC squared are sort of the icons of the nuclear age. So there's nothing quite like that. I mean, Einstein's as a revolutionary scientific figure has analogies with, say, Darwin or Newton. But Darwin and Newton weren't state-changing figures, right? They weren't figures whose thoughts were directly associated in their time with a transformative form of warfare and potential destruction.
I actually have a question about, I don't know why it hasn't occurred to me before, but when this piece was written, Einstein really was associated with the atomic bomb, and I think there was a general, maybe an almost anti-scientific feeling largely centered around the destructive technologies that had come just before the 70s, and I think there's a quite different attitude, in at least in some broader circles, towards technology and science at this point. I know in my generation, especially the next generation, there's a certain adulation of technology. And do you think that's how do you think that might change the way new audiences who have never had a chance to experience this before might experience this piece?
I mean, it's interesting, you know, and it's, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, when I was in high school, when I was learning relativity theory, and I used to sneak into the science building and work with, I was the only one in my class who was interested in taking physics, and I had some very talented colleagues in science, but physics was, you know, it was you know, we were all very anti-Vietnam War, but it was, you know, it was considered just one step short of plastic shrapnel that wouldn't show up on X-rays. I mean, it was, you know, so it was sort of samizdat physics, and you know, after the end of the Cold War, there was a period where the atomic bomb seemed to fade from our cultural landscape, and now it comes back, you know, in the constantly repeated refrains about, you know, the terrorist bomb or the rogue state bomb. It's not the Cold War array of symmetric powers, Warsaw Pact versus NATO with, you know, tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. It's a world where atomic weapons show up in our fearful late-night television as the small terrorist cell or the loose nukes from the Pakistanis or the North Koreans or something. So I think it has changed, and not that it's disappeared, but I think it registers differently, and I think for the generation younger than you, it'll appear yet differently again. But if you came of age in the 1990s, then the hope for a disappeared Cold War world that would lead, you know, where nuclear weapons would play no role, has not quite been realized. But it's not the world of the Cold War either, right? It's something else. It's this amorphous, fearful post 9/11 world.
Yeah, I guess I meant it in terms of how it reflects on science as a sort of big S.
I agree. I think science now, you know, science is, first of all, science and technology are much more closely associated, whether it's bioengineering or new pharmaceutical things, or both of us have computers sitting on the table in front of us, you know, and Facebook and software and you know, science is the killer app and the new device. Science is sort of the software and the computer hardware that have transformed our world from the inside out. Mm-hmm. Not so much with a new airplane as a new way of communicating and distributing information, like podcasts.
Yeah, indeed. Yes.
So I think that is true, and I imagine that the fearfulness of the Cold War is not part of a new generation now coming of age, and they wouldn't see science in quite that dual role. They might be worried about nuclear weapons, but I don't think most, you know, my kids would never think, well, science is a problem because of the atomic bomb. I mean, they would just think, well, there are atomic bombs in the world, and, you know, that's a bad thing.
Yeah, I don't think they associate them with Einstein or physics, even, really. I guess we're probably completely running out of time, but I have one more sort of frivolous question. Do you know this anecdote about Einstein and the string quartet that he played with occasionally? And one of the other members who was asked how Einstein was as a violinist. Do you know this anecdote?
Yes.
Will you tell it?
Well, I think Einstein, Leon Botstein, who has written a wonderful piece in a book I edited called Einstein for the 21st Century, wrote a wonderful piece about Einstein and music, and, you know, he truly loved the music, but he was certainly not a a great violinist. I'm not sure what...
The anecdote that the way it's come down to me is someone asked one of the other members of the quartet how this great scientist Einstein was as a violinist, and was told, well, he can't count.
Yeah, you know, I think that...
You've never heard that.
I hadn't heard that.
I don't know anything about its veracity.
But, I mean, there's certainly a way in which... I mean, Einstein was very classical. He liked Bach. He liked, you know, he liked actually, in some ways, you know, the more mathematical forms of music that Bach, in some ways, stood for. The highly structured and controlled compositions of Bach. I think, you know, now I'm actually collaborating on a piece with the artist William Kentridge called The Refusal of Time.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, it occurs to me in our discussion that, you know, it never crossed our minds to make nuclear weapons part of the story. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was not because nuclear weapons don't exist, but because in some sense using our interest is in the transition between the absolute time, relativistic time, and the sort of breakdown of time in the presence of black holes and the conflicts of contemporary physics. Mm-hmm. But I do think that for as hard as it is to remember, it's important to remember how vivid the ambivalence was towards science in the high points of the Cold War. And that's the world out of which, you know, that surrounded the time of the writing of Einstein on the Beach.
Yes.
And I think that it's helpful not because Einstein on the Beach is just about that. It's not a report. It's an excursion artistically into a kind of ethos of a moment, and very movingly so, I think, in which rationality had this double edge of a promise and a terrible fear.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, we should leave it at that. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Peter Gallison.
Thank you, Peter. You both did pretty well for before coffee conversation.
It was during coffee.
During coffee,
yes.
Okay. And I'm curious, when you called him and asked for an interview and then interviewed him, did you realize he was famous?
Well, maybe not the extent to which he is famous.
Mm, yeah. Well, very nice of him to...
I also went to his full lecture.
To slum
lecture.
On our podcast.
I know, it's so nice. It was so nice of you. If he ever listens to this podcast, I will be honored. I'm sure he won't.
Yeah.
No, I also went to his later talk, which was totally fascinating. And he said a lot of the same things that he had said to me, but went on and talked more about the theory of relativity. It was very cool. And now I'm going to go out and read his book and look for some of his films.
Cool. So there will be more in upcoming weeks and months. There will be more episodes of Haiting interviewing scientists around the world. And next week, though, I believe we're going to have another news from the Monkey Scope, probably to get caught up on the music news.
Yeah, now that we're both in the same place at the same time.
Yeah.
Looking at the same news. All right. Thanks for listening to Scopes Monkey Choir.
From scopesmonkeychoir.com.
We are professional musicians, not scientists.
If you don't believe something we've said, look it up yourself.
We love feedback. You can write to us at scopesmonkeychoir@gmail.com.
Or call the monkey phone and leave a message. I don't know the number by heart, so look on our website.
Write us a review on iTunes.
And all those things. I tweet at Squidocto.
And I tweet at Scopes Monkeys.
Until next week.
Bye.